Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 14th, 2005. Today's session is a forum entitled How Do We Measure Happiness? Facilitated by Renita Falkenstern. Disc number FO 2005-22.
Okay, so I'm Renita Falkenstern, and this forum is How Do We Measure Happiness? And it's come out of and been inspired by the sessions that John DeGraff has been doing this week relating to how Americans are running out of time and how and different ways that we can take back our time. So we're going to get right to it. We're going to start with a little skit. And to set it up, I'm going to read a passage from Gospel of Mark, chapter 6. The apostles gathered around Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. He said to them, "Come away to a deserted place, all by yourselves, and rest a while." For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat.
Oh, hey, Mark!
Oh, hey!
Hi, John!
How are you guys
doing?
Hey, how was that hike to Image?
Oh, it was great.
How was your run?
Oh, I'd love to tell you more. I totally have to.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm totally.
Me too.
I feel like I haven't seen you guys for forever.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
We should have dinner or something.
Yeah, catch up.
Hey, Dad and Dorothy are coming back on Saturday, so we should all we should do like a family dinner.
Yeah, yeah, they would love that.
But well, let's do it. Can we do it second setting? Because at 5 I'm teaching on Saturday. Would that work for you?
Actually, second dinner I'm rehearsing for Vespers.
Oh,
yeah, and Dad's going to be showing that one movie that everybody always likes.
Oh,
yeah.
So that's not going
to
work afterwards.
Yeah,
okay.
How about Sunday, the new day of rest, the next day?
Let me see.
I'm working. Yeah.
I'm working afternoon. You're working morning.
Yeah,
and I have dish team.
So we're all working on Sunday. Okay, that's
okay.
We'll just cross that out.
We'll just
go to Monday.
Monday, right?
We'll go to Monday.
Oh, I'm signed up for that. For Loom, and I really should work on that.
Yeah, and I'm flirting with a new guy.
I thought I'd try my hand at that spiritual direction. So.
Oh, the spiritual direction. You
so,
totally should
yeah,
do that.
Yeah,
I feel
you
like
really
I
should.
Need
yeah,
to,
do that. Do
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
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 Okay, how about this? We both have Wednesday after
Vespers. After
Vespers.
Perfect. Well, after Vespers.
It's an event.
Community is so important.
We can't skip it.
No,
no.
Oh, I know. Okay, Thursday after.
Nothing's happening Thursday after Vespers, so we'll do a forum skit.
You don't want to be the guy.
Okay, we'll do it.
Okay, let me try
to
end the door here. Okay.
What time do you, don't you leave next week?
Like, I leave next Saturday.
Lunch
next Saturday.
Do it for lunch.
Yeah, but it should be second lunch.
Yeah, and I know my mom has to do
announcements
before and after,
yeah.
But
right,
we've got that 15 minutes.
Right, and I have to get on the bus, but there'll be at least
15 minutes.
Just
pack early.
Great.
Yeah,
I'll see you guys then lunch next Saturday for those 15
minutes. Yeah.
Okay,
I'll see you then.
Yeah. Guys, we don't even know if this is going to work for them.
Oh, yeah.
Hang on, but it's okay. I'll just call them on my cell.
Oh,
that won't work either. But,
oh, well.
You guys want that?
Thank you to Martha, and John. So, now we have four panelists. You can come forward now. And we're kind of going from older to younger. Oh, I don't see vinyl here yet. I guess you would hit there. And Rose. Does anybody know where Minor is? I think it might be with the junior minors, but I sound outside of the rest.
Do you want me to go with
them? Sure, if you would. And we'll, when it comes, we'll have you come to. So I've asked them each to think about a moment, an experience, an event from their childhood that was a positive memory. Maybe if they had a photo album and they were flipping through it and there was a picture and that they might be stopping on that picture and explaining that positive memory from their childhood to you. And I have no idea what they're going to do. I never set it up or gave them any hints, so we'll see what emerges. So we'll start with Rose.
Okay. Can you stand?
No, whatever.
Okay.
Before my mom and dad got married, Daddy bought a 1929 Ford. Oh, it was a beautiful car. It had all like velvet inside. It was beautiful. And it was parked in the garage almost all the time, except when we washed it or on Sundays when we went to church or went for a ride. And it was very narrow. My mom and dad just sat in the front seat. And my sister sat in the bed. Lena sat on one side. I sat on the other side. And my brother John, there was a like an armrest in the middle. And John rode that like a horse. That was his horsey. It didn't have a radio, but it had a horn. And it seemed like one of those Uga horns that you hear on the old cars when they had the antique cars bridge. Anyway, my dad liked to blow that horn a lot, and he did. He blew it a lot. It was like you could drive up to the service station and get a dollar's worth of gas, and that gas maybe lasted all week. Why, I sure wished I had that car now.
Thank you.
I tried to find a particular instance or incident and kind of focused on a time period rather than a particular moment. And I remember as a family, I was raised by my mother, who was a single parent, and we would often go to my grandparents. And my grandparents was like, it was the focal center of all the extended family. A lot of times I would see my cousins there, aunts and uncles, extended cousins and aunts and uncles. It was a meeting place for everybody. And It was always a happy occasion, because whenever we got there, there was just for the kids, and I was in my 12, 11, or somewhere in that age frame. The first thing we would do is just all band together and invent games. We had the run of the place. We had about an acre of land behind the house, and we'd run around, climb trees, sometimes get in trouble, but it was always usually short-lived. We just invented things. We had the most simple things became magic. I remember finding 2x4 little blocks of wood, drawing faces and dials on them, and then pretending they were walkie-talkies. And we played with those for hours. We just had a great time. The most simple things became very complex. And it didn't matter who was there, you know, but we always found a way to make it a real fun time. I think we were kind of carefree, and just we always knew it was going to be fun. It was just a loving atmosphere, and it was always family. So it was just a real good time, and I just remember that being a real warm feeling.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I tried to pick out a specific memory as well, and I actually found it pretty difficult, because I think when a lot of people try to remember things from their childhood, they remember like incidents of injury or like travel, you know, new things, or else like kind of ritual holiday things that kind of turn almost generic, like just playing in the backyard kind of general things. But I remember one time when my sister always came in the summer to visit us in Valparaiso, and that was always fun because she lived in Minneapolis, and we would put on some productions sometimes in the basement and kind of transform the basement. We had a bunch of blankets and hang them from the ceilings, you know, like forts. And I just remember one time we did a production of The Christmas Carol in the middle of summer. And John was 10, Tim. And I just remember this one brief moment from it where John was standing on this chair kind of in the middle of the basement, and I was holding this old Fisher Price flashlight that kind of had different colors. It was bulky. And I was kind of holding it, you know, as a spotlight. And I think that there were maybe, apparently John told me, he was trying to help refresh my memory, like some toilet paper streamers going on for some lighting effects. And we were playing Eric Clapton's Tears from Heaven in the background. And I think it was like Pantheon was going to die or something. I don't know. It was very poignant. The poignant moment of the play. That's why I remember it, I guess. And it was a lot of fun. And that's what I remember.
So, when I talked to Vinyl, what he had mentioned as a possible story was sitting around at supper time, meal time, and everybody would sit on the floor and just put your foot, food on the floor. And there would be parents there and grandparents, and the extended family would gather. And after the mealtime, there would be a time for evening devotions and storytelling, and it would go on quite a long time into the evening. So thank you to Martha and George and Rose for joining us and sharing your stories. Of what were the things that emerged as things that they valued?
Creativity.
Can you see that? Is it too low for you up there?
Family.
Kind of family.
Is it here?
Yeah. So. Did you hear it more than that?
Extended.
Yeah. I heard the grandparents, right? Even. And even cousins from George.
Having fun.
You might say that even visitors became family.
Where did you hear that?
Oh, we got a big enough group, they always get invited. Oh, pardon me.
There he is.
Okay. Hi, Vina. Did you want to join us for a second and just tell... Oh, that's all right. I kind of described a little bit of what you told me the other night, but maybe you can put in your own words. Do you want to do it right now? The memory that you wanted to share from your family?
Oh.
I probably, you can tell now how wrong I got it. So, a memory.
I'm fine, from Namibia. I just forgot, we discussed this yesterday, and I thought you said yesterday night.
Oh, okay. That's
and
okay.
I was here taking my day. Then I just saw it. So
that's all right.
I really forgot. Now what is that?
Family, childhood memory.
Oh. So we were talking about what are the memories that I could remember from my childhood. Our family, well, my family. So, you know, I mean, I think it's different from people to people or from country to country, because, like in the culture where I am, my parents. They don't have jobs, they are not employed. However, they have, they just work at home as farmers. And most of the time, they use it to just to wait either in the field or somewhere home. And as I can see here in the United States, and I think it's the same as in Europe, so the time of being with your kids, with the kids, is so limited, because if you are very young, maybe you are 1, 2, 3 years, or 2, 4, you can have time with your family, with your parents. But once you are 5, upwards, so you don't have real time again with your parents. So you just maybe meet at the meal. When you are eating, it's the time you meet. Then maybe have a certain conversation, and then after, each one goes to his or her responsibility or she's supposed to do. So, but as I can see here, the Americans, they usually, I mean, they most of the times they use their time being with their family, taking them somewhere for a vacation, being together, or traveling together for a certain time. But that is not the case, let me say, not really in the world country, but in some, let me say, in my family. And this is just because, you know, it is not easy to travel for us. We don't really enjoy traveling. But we can also visit other relatives or friends. But maybe this can only be done, maybe the parents are the ones to go and visit. Maybe we can take one child, but the youngest one. But sometimes they can also choose from the teenagers whom they go with. So it's very scary. I mean, it's very, it's not so often, understand me. And in most cases, the children are on their own. And the other thing that I have experienced here is that here you eat at the same table. The Europeans and the Americans, they eat at the same table, which is not the case in some of people, in some people in Namibia. We can be at the same place, but not eating at the same table. So the kids are on their in their part, having their food there, and the parents on their on the other side. And sometimes it can happen that kids can stay somewhere, either in the kitchen, eating there, and then they only come together when it's time for a devotion, or a evening devotion. And then from there, everybody's trying to swarm.
Okay.
So, maybe the thing which is making it difficult for some of the people in Namibia is because they don't really have an access to move. You guys, you are free, you can go anywhere. You budget, okay, I will use this money to go and visit some one country in Africa or somewhere in Europe or somewhere else. So, but for us, it's not so easy to go very far. So.
But you did have, what I'm hearing is that you did have an evening meal together. Would there be just your immediate family? Would there be extended family there?
Yes, you know, the families in Namibia, they are big. We live, can find more than 10 people in the family. This is including the extended families.
Eating together, or eating
Yeah.
For supper, we'd gather.
Just you gather at the same time, maybe, or somewhere, but not really at the same table.
Okay.
You know,
sort of more,
not all of us using the table, you know.
Yeah.
You can just sit there on the ground, eating there, taking, I mean, the food from the same plate. Yeah, that is what I want to say. So,
okay.
Eating from the same plate, the, maybe let me say four, the other plate, and the four, and the other plate. So,
yeah,
that's how it happens.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. We already heard stories from the other four, so you can just take a seat wherever you want to. Thank you very much. and we're just putting down on the board some of the things that we heard that were things that people valued from their childhood experience. So let's just keep on going. Is there anything else that you, either from Vino's story or any of the other stories earlier on that we haven't put down yet?
Meal time.
Okay.
Yeah.
And together.
I'd like to expand on creativity. There's a make do, which isn't like there's something missing. It's a this is what we have and we're going to maximize it.
Could you say there's an element of imagination and,
yes,
and
exactly.
Play? John talked about, or George talked about having a piece of wood, putting a dial on it, and turning it into a walkie-talkie, so that it takes some imagination.
Devotions?
Devotions. And also we heard play with Martha, definitely, the productions that would take place, the Christmas Carol drama. Definitely, as far as imagination, in terms of costuming and the entire production.
Well, sometimes.
Oh, well, it was me. But I would say rituals too, like even just Thanksgivings. Like we think about, you know, we visit grandma once a year. You know, like.
Possession to the, like a car. Where you gather around that thing. And some people it's a boat or it's a car.
Is it a special? Like how can we get it at the way it was a special for? Like I got a sense
yeah,
it was a new thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So was it the
everybody
car? I wonder about that. Was it the car or was it the event? It became an event for the whole family, right? And, and you had a whole family memory attached to it. So
I remember a woody wagon though from the 70s very distinctly. It was the whole car.
And the fun that took place in it.
Okay.
your own childhood that we've missed.
Well, to add on to this idea of a possession, I think of almost like, I don't want to say ownership, but just the idea of having a place of one's own, that a place to create, like the car or the basement or the field, you know.
And we had cooperation.
Space for play.
Cooperation with the creativity going on, the game playing and the drama and everything. Sounds like also with the meals.
How about
so there's some
freedom?
Sense of shared. Work, shared play.
Both. How about freedom?
Want to say more about that?
Well, freedom to do a lot of, even if it's very limited.
You can do a lot, even if you're very limited?
Yeah.
Freedom is what you do with what ties you down. I heard Richard Kemmer say once, that painter. Anything else from your own childhood that's been missed?
Well,
we've covered quite a bit.
I would just say, like, I don't know about freedom, because I think that a lot of times good creative things happen when you're just stuck with people. You know,
like,
you can say, well, yeah, you can say, unless you're stuck with these people, like, Louisiana or whatever, and you have to, you know, make do and
make do.
Yeah.
The sharing time and space.
Yeah, and you're stuck with the next door neighbors, and they become your best friends. You know, I mean, I think choice is sometimes a negative thing.
It seems like they tend to be kind of relational. It's not just cooperation, but it's what happens dynamically in relationships.
I still echo your freedom in that. We were kids, we would go away at sunrise and come back at sunset, and you know, you just don't see that today in kids.
Could you have talk about that maybe in relationship to time?
Or go away at sunrise and come back at sunset.
Yeah, we weren't scheduled.
Unsupervised. It's related to that. Unsupervised and unstructured.
Yeah, just completely unsupervised and unstructured. At least we thought it was unsupervised. For all we know.
Okay, that's probably enough.
You could put it in quotes.
The lady that mentioned the 29-4, I expect her to mention that somebody had to crank that thing to get it going.
Yeah, that was part of the adventure. Yeah. It was a sense of adventure. She had that right on there, too. Fun. Adventure. So this is one of the things that they suggest doing in the Take Back Your Time campaign, is meeting with your congregation or your family and thinking about memory from your childhood. I think part of the reason is because what we see emerge are our values, the things that we care most about. And it also, I think, relates then to our time. And most, I think, like what comes up again and again are the relationships that are all the way through us. So before we think more then about time or happiness, we want to get a philosophical perspective on this. So I've asked Michael Pellett to talk for a few minutes just to kind of give a framework about how we understand happiness in the past.
This is the Western philosophy of happiness. And most
5,000 feet.
Time in 5 minutes. We'll talk first of all about Plato and Aristotle. And the key thing about Plato and Aristotle in all of this is they want to make a distinction between pleasure and happiness. Pleasure is that which deals with our desires, like the desire of hunger, thirst, whatever. Pleasures can never be satiated. They can never be fulfilled, because no matter how good a meal you have, how full you feel, you'll be hungry again. Greek mythology illustrates that in terms of basically what hell is like is never being able to fulfill your desire. Think about poor Sisyphus. Right, that guy who's pushing the rock up to the top of the mountain, and what does it do? Roll back down again. So he pushes that rock up the top. That's work, work, work.
Or skit at the beginning.
Your skit. Another issue is, or another example is Tantalus. He's the guy who stands in the middle of the stream to bend down and get the water, and by the time it reaches his mouth, it's always gone. He's always thirsty. He can never get that water to slake his throat. That's us, the life of desire. And according to Plato and Aristotle, if all we do is lead our lives to fulfill our desires, we will always be unpleasured and unhappy, because pleasure can only be, desires can only be fulfilled for the instant, and then they return again. And so, of course, the wise person, the one who understands this, is going to pursue happiness. And happiness, the Greek word for that, eudaimonion, You means good, daimon means demon, or if you will, spirit. To be happy is to truly be good-spirited. You are in good spirits. And what that sense means is that one is truly human. And of course, that's what philosophy would be all about. Philosophy isn't going to tell you how to fulfill your desires. Philosophy is going to help you be truly human. And you can do that in moral ways and moral virtues and intellectual ways and intellectual virtues. And what helps you do that are friends or friendship and politics. And again, politics is just simply the community of citizens working together. And this is particularly Aristotle, that it is friendship, it is through friendship and politics that we enable to one another to be truly human. Now we'll skip a few years. We'll go to the German philosopher Immanuel Kant, who likes happiness and not pleasure, but Kant's position on this is that our duty equals our happiness. So Kant's not a fun-loving guy. What he means by that is that our duty and happiness, he summarizes it in what he calls the categorical imperative. And one of the versions of the categorical imperative is that one should act toward oneself and all other human beings as ends in themselves and never as means. Now, an end in itself means that you're a good in itself, an intrinsic good. Something good in itself means it's good just because it is. So for Kant, human beings are good in themselves simply because they're human. And therefore, you treat other humans as simply human and a good in themselves. It is impermissible, immoral, to simply use them. So it is not, you are not doing your duty, you are not pursuing happiness if you simply use another person to achieve your own ends, your own goals, your own purposes. And so, for example, for Kant, an easy example on this is lying. Lying is immoral because basically what you're doing is you're telling a person a falsehood, you're making a false promise in order to use them to get something for yourself. And you are not treating that person as a good in itself without integrity, and so on. So therefore, when you always live according to the categorical imperative, then you are a truly happy person. So says Mr. Kant. The last one I want to look at is the utilitarian principle. Put together, folks here, the philosophers here are the English philosophers Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill. And the utilitarian principle is the greatest good for the greatest number. That's what provides happiness. Now the distinction here is, what do we mean by good? Someone like Bentham wants to put good in terms of quantity. So like the greatest amount of steak for the greatest number of people would make you happy. Unless you're vegan. But that, Mill wants to put good in terms of quality. That there are certain qualities in life. So that, for example, Mill's favorite phrase on that is, I would rather be Socrates dissatisfied than a pig satisfied.
Right.
So that what makes for the happiness in life and the greatest good for the greatest number is some kind of qualitative understanding, not sheer quantity and like having all the food I want or whatever that might be. And that at least within Western philosophy, as we try to understand what is the notion of happiness, these are the three predominant ideas which thinkers have worked with. The notion of Plato and Aristotle, happiness as pursuing that sense of truly human, Kant's categorical imperative, always treating humans as a good in themselves, and the utilitarian principle, greatest good for the greatest number, depending now on does good for you mean quantity or quality. If you understand that, then you're happy.
Great, thank you for the summary. So, I guess the question is, what happened? And we know that this is not our experience in terms of, we don't see a lot more our children having the same kind of freedom and unstructured time that we had. We feel dehumanized in our workplaces. Some of the things that are mentioned in the Take Back Your Time resources: Americans work an average of 9 full weeks, 350 hours, more per year than European workers. From 1973 to 2000, the average U.S. worker added an additional 199 hours to his or her annual work schedule. Americans have by far the shortest paid vacations in the industrialized world. America is the only country in the industrialized world that doesn't have a law guaranteeing paid vacation time. And 26% of American workers don't take any vacation at all. 80% of men and 62% of women put in more than 40 hours a week on the job. We work longer hours than medieval peasants did. And the skit at the beginning, too, is supposed to illustrate something that I think all of you find fairly familiar, not just in your places at home, but even here at Holden, where we're supposed to be this nirvana, this retreat center, right? That we ourselves get caught in the same whirlwind of never being able to find time, always running out of time. I like to call that, another title for that play could probably be A Vision of Hell. So I think that sometimes when I'm sitting around with my students, I'm a campus chaplain, and we're very, very pressed for time, students, trying to find a time in everyone's schedule. We can actually schedule a Bible study or a book discussion or a supper, and we just go on and on and around, and I just feel like this is what hell must be like, never being able to find a time.
This morning, I'm new to the village, so I don't really know any of the staffers, but there was a teenage guy, maybe he was 19, reading a book, sitting in one of those Adirondack chairs. And another person who looked like he worked here came up to him and said, I'm sorry to bother you on your day off, but... And then he proceeded to, like, talk to him about something or other. And then the two of them, you know, he had to put his book down, and the two of them went off to the hotel for something they had to do. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Whatever it was, I don't know who they were, and I don't know what had to be done on this person's day off. But
there are always things that want to encroach on
our time. That guy should not sit by the hotel on his day off. He should go up the mountain. He should hide somewhere.
You need an invisibility cloak. No one knows you're here. So I thought we should try to use our imaginations and try to imagine what the world would be like if we were in charge. And we were not measuring and making policies according to the gross national product, which is often the most important thing that's taken into consideration when making public policy. Gross domestic product, the problem with it is that it only really measures the economic growth.
But even if there's a forest fire, the gross national or gross domestic product goes up, right? So Holden Village came pretty close to getting engulfed by flames last summer, but that wasn't very good for Holden, but it was good for the gross domestic product because that went up. Or any time that there's a war, that's, you know, the money is exchanged hands and that makes the GDP go up. If there's a car accident or crime, that also makes the GDP go up. So you can see that they're not, that indicator isn't going to be measuring things that are necessarily good for human well-being. They just measure economic growth anytime that money changes hands. And they don't take into consideration natural environment, or the effects on the environment, I should say. So if we were going to try to think of indicators for well-being, you know, what do we have to do at a national level to create well-being in America? How do we create a gross national happiness index? So the question is, how do we measure what matters in terms of human well-being? What are the well-being accounts that we should monitor as human indicators of progress? So what are the things that we would want to measure to try to measure human well-being? And not just at an individual level, but for our nation. Get some more white space. keep in mind some of the things that we've retrieved from our memories here and from our philosophical tour through history. But you have to remember them because you won't be able to see them. So, for example, in the area of time, what might be one of the things that we would want to measure?
Family meal times.
Or we could even try to broaden that to say time with family.
Sense, we, in a broader, in our country, we enjoy a very nice lifestyle, a very nice standard of living, and all that stuff. It allows us to do these kinds of things. And I think people from other countries who are a lot poorer than we are look at discussions like this, and they kind of wonder about this a little bit. And so, hey, you guys are pretty darn rich, pretty darn comfortable, you know, gee whiz, how can you be unhappy? So you were talking about time. In the United States, about a recent survey showed 42% of the people in the United States worry about not having enough leisure time. And they asked people in China the same question, and the percentage there that worried about having enough leisure time was about 17%. The reason I think it was less there than here is while they may not know Plato from Kant, they understand intuitively, I think, hierarchy of need. And in their situation, they will work extra time to hit some of those basics of life. Food, shelter, things like that. I think eventually, you know, maybe as their economy gets better, they'll start worrying about some self-actualization issues that we're hitting. So, you know, if it's me and I'm thinking about, okay, I'm going to run the country and, you know, I have some ideas for the country, you know, I personally, I'd rather we spend more time, you know, helping out in Africa, taking some of our surplus and moving it away from here.
Okay.
That would be what I'd do.
Well, what would you want to call that? Aid?
Yeah.
Global aid.
If we have spare food, give the spare food.
I think that one of the things John Greff gave me this magazine. It's all about the science of happiness. And you talk about one of the things that we find as the greatest source of happiness is engagement with others, or service of others, right? We don't just exist for ourselves. I think that's the lie that, you know, that idea that pleasure is what really fulfills us, right? That's what we see on the advertisers, in the commercials every day. But really, the source of happiness is when we can serve the other, when we lose our story within someone else's story. That's also a sense of vocation, if you want to use a theological word. So I think that this definitely fits.
Well, to put that in the context of time, and it's actually, for a lot of people, the canary in the coal mine, first to go. And actually, family time, I won't sacrifice that. And so, but charitable time for doing the politics, as Aristotle is putting it, working for the community, that's the first to go. I mean, that's what I cut back on. I'm not going to cut back on my family time, but I'm going to cut back on. So, like, I used to mentor eighth graders. I don't do it anymore.
So, like,
volunteering.
That would be one of the things
time.
That we could measure is how many...
Charitable time and volunteer time.
Because
that's kind of like the... That's going to go before the family time, I think, in a lot of people.
I just moved to a retirement area, Sun City, and it's called the City Volunteers. And there's, when you look around, like I moved there and I didn't know anybody when I moved there. And you look around, you've got all these people who maybe they've lost their spouse, maybe they've been divorced, maybe for some reason or other, they're really singular. And they get out and they volunteer and they do things for other people. And it satisfies their time. Other people go for, when they have money, they go for voyages, you know, they go on the luxury liners and take the trips and stuff. But it just seems like there's a lot of satisfaction in doing your time, being voluntary. And the Bible says, whatever you do for the least of my people, you do also for me. And it's a satisfaction that I don't think, I feel like the next generation isn't seeing this like we are. It's what I'm trying to say.
Time for community, I think, is again what you're saying.
Is it required?
Again, they talked about that we tend to think, and I see I'm guilty of this too, that when we have a spare moment, that we would want to just go home and be by ourselves and do nothing. So we're kind of setting ourselves up for the opposite of happiness, and it's actually very empty in a way. And we're happiest when we are with other people. It's not really anything that's a big surprise.
But I think we have to feed our vessels before we feed others.
Hmm.
Because I'm a retired teacher, and most of my kids were always Hispanic. And I would tell, and I was old enough at the time, I was telling the parents this, and I said, and many of them were single parents, and I said, if you don't feed your vessel, take the bubble bath by yourself, lock the door, just little tiny things, you can't fill anyone else's cup. And I don't think it's being selfish. I think we need to do that also.
Okay, so it could be time, but that was just one area. It could be in the area of work or the environment, education, different things. So it's open to other indicators that would promote well-being among Americans. Yes.
I think probably one of the things that cramps our style is the desire to have things.
So how would we, if we're going to measure somehow something, try to make a public policy, how would we create a way of monitoring that?
Well, what's a necessity first?
Say that again?
What's a necessity?
What's a necessity?
So instead of a GDP, a GDM, where you measure what percentage of the population actually achieves the necessities, and then don't count the rest of the gross national product.
One of the things that the Australian Institute has come up with was discourage materialism and promote responsible advertising. You know, if most of us have television, and it's kind of command central for consumer society. You know, that could we? They suggest doing things like, as in Sweden, advertising aimed at children under 12 could be banned, and advertising codes of conduct could be made legally binding, so that irresponsible and deceptive marketing is outlawed. One thought from the Australian Institute.
Then you'd have higher employment of advertisers.
Okay. Up there, yeah. Other indicators of well-being?
Physical health.
Yeah, for sure.
Most people have more time, probably eat better, and have more time to exercise.
Yeah. And that's part of taking care of yourself, too.
There's so many people, though, in our society and in our world that aren't even up to having time to worry about having time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Someone mentioned the hierarchy of needs.
Yeah.
You know, without basic services and good education and health care and food, and you know, this is, it's kind of arrogant for us to sit around and think, I need more free time. Mm-hmm. Other people don't even have the energy to think about having free time.
Other arguments? Response to that? John, I'm going to ask John to come in at that point. What, in terms of, can you say something about, I noticed in the, I'm just a novice in this area, but in terms of the level of happiness is actually quite high in countries where there isn't, like Latin America, for example, right, that isn't really a lot of material wealth, but they experience a great deal of a sense of well-being. So, you want to say anything more about that to kind of provide some, like, why are Americans, if we are comfortable, why are we experiencing the more depression and mental health is really on the increase?
Who would you like me to?
Are we just a bunch of whiners, or?
Well, I don't think so. But then that's, you know, I think. And in fact, what I, you know, one finds, I think, when one goes to third world countries, is that one thing people do have is time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that it is something that, you know, people always have time to stop on the street and take time to visit and to do those kind of things. I mean, that's the one observation that they, you know, is they always wonder why we're in such a hurry. I think that's a I don't think it's whiny. I mean, I think if we want to turn our country around, we can't just tell everybody they should feel guilty. You know, we can't just say you got everything, so you should feel bad and give it away and do these kind of things. Maybe true, but it doesn't work. And so I think we have to talk about what we lose in our consumer lifestyle, and one of the things we lose is time for each other, you know, which is big, because it's what we know makes us happy.
I think we have to recognize the polarization that's been taking place in our country for about the last 30 or 40 years in terms of wealth. And everyone here, I'm going to assume, has got the money to be here and so forth, but when we look at 47 million Americans who don't have health coverage, and for whom a medical emergency can absolutely bankrupt them, who are living day to day from paychecks, I don't think it's whining when we talk about we need to provide everyone with the right to health care. I was listening to a panel of people who had traveled in Europe just last week at City Club in Seattle, and they said, you know, in Europe, health care is a right. Everyone expects to have it. It isn't something that people go to bed at night worrying about. Am I going to get an illness? Am I going to break a leg? Am I going to be in a car accident? So I think, you know, there's two groups of people in this country, basically. People who have made it and people who are not making it.
Yes, people we have heard from.
For me, what has brought me the greatest happiness is education. And I came late in life, and I was brought up poor. And I think that a college education today is the equivalent of a high school education 25, 30 years ago. And as far as universal health care, yes, of course, universal education as well. And I think that too many of our students, are worried about going into business and making enough money instead of pursuing happiness through learning, and they can't afford to.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry to go along with that, but that the idea that we live Monday through Friday because we know Saturday and Sunday are coming, and I mean the idea that we need education, or we need to do something that, you know, we can be happy on Monday even though it's the first day of the week and we have to work for four more days, that somehow, I mean, what we do to allow ourselves to have free time also satisfies us.
Maybe there's a whole a cultural change in how we even talk about this and the language you use and in the statistics that we raise in our own lives. For example, we're proud, most of us are, admit it, right, that I worked a 60-hour week. And we say that with a little bit of pride, and we complain, but we're actually kind of proud of that. Maybe we should start counting, you know what, I took four naps this week. I'll bet nobody in here will be proud of that. That's not part of the Protestant work ethic and the whole system brought up. So I put it down as a concrete thing. Count the hours we played, and count instead of the hours we worked, and count the hours we napped, and count the hours we drank beer.
So Wisconsin's the happiest.
You know, the nap before
eat cheese.
I don't think it is.
You and then you.
It seems to me that across countries we measure how well a country is doing by the average level of income, and I think that really gets us off the mark. I think we need to measure the standard deviation or the range of income.
The gap.
Some statistical measure of the gap, and look for that to be declining.
That's one of the ones that's mentioned by the Australian Institute as well. Talk about a fairer society.
And I think that means that an educated population needs to ask politicians for those figures whenever the figures that they're getting are ones about levels, average levels of income.
Thank you. George?
One of the things that it's an old saying, but I remember it always kind of struck home to me about what happiness really meant, and putting it in context, I've done a couple of mission trips down to Mexico and was amazed at how impoverished people were there, but how happy they were. And the saying is that you're better off wanting what you have, not having what you want. And so if you want what you have, you're happy. But if you're searching, if you're always looking to have what you want, it doesn't work.
And that's, I think, related to what the woman before you spoke, right? If there we have these huge disparities between rich and poor, there's always the Joneses of the other who is doing so much better than, not that we don't have enough, but that's such a psychological category, right? That sense of how much is enough.
And some people can be extremely happy with nothing.
Mm-hmm. Others who we haven't heard from yet. Okay. Final.
I just want to say something about that. You know, the one person just stated that, it means just this way. You know, the rich people never sleep. While we are sleeping, that person is just awake. If he's not driving, he's sitting, doing something for the next time. And if he's not driving, he's writing something, what to do next. So, from there, I've really experienced that there is a difference. You know, just want to relate to what he said, that, and this might be go with pleasure, maybe what. So the more you have, the more you need. So, you know, the moment you know that I have this, you still, I mean, aiming to, I don't know where you are aiming to. You will never stop, I mean, doing that. And that this is what maybe making you not to have enough time or anything. So I just express myself. So
desires that can never be fulfilled. Yeah. What we heard in the philosophy lesson, as opposed to the goal being friendship and relationships and being truly human, which is often, again, another, am I correct here, but Desmond Tutu in his book, God Has a Dream, it's just his new book, talks about Ubuntu from one African language, I'm not sure, the idea that we are made truly human in community, that I'm not whole unless I receive the gifts of the other, and you're not whole without my gifts that I share. And if you were to ask someone how you're doing, they would say, we are well, or we are not well. Because if their grandmother is not well, then the whole family is not well. So the sense of, I am who I am through community, through the other.
Yeah, kind of going off that, I think that one way that we could encourage happiness and full happiness is through community. And so I'm thinking stuff like block parties or just holidays in which entire communities would gather together. I mean, beyond the bond, or just the bonds of family, but of people who live in your surrounding area, of people who live in the same city, especially people from different cultures. I feel if there were times and places where we could get together like that, I think we'd all be enriched.
We're pretty much out of time.